loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, former presidential advisor Roger Stone entered not guilty pleas on 7 felony counts in a federal court in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and then immediately took to the airwaves to proclaim his innocence, to repeat that he will not testify against the president, and to warn the president that the Mueller investigation could mean the end of his presidency. Next, large-scale protests are taking place in Venezuela today after the Supreme Court moved to freeze Juan Guaido's bank accounts and to impose a travel ban on him. Guaido responded by calling on the military to side with him, and he asked the United States to send weapons and advisors to help him overthrow the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Then, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, CIA Director Gina Haspel, and FBI Director Christopher Wray delivered their annual intelligence threat assessment yesterday in an open hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Notably, they contradicted Donald Trump on nearly every major issue, the Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs, ISIS, and China, for example. When asked directly if the president was hampering their abilities to do their jobs, all three declined to answer in an open forum. And then the U.S. and China met today to try to dig out from a damaging trade war with a new round of high-level talks aimed at bridging deep differences over China's intellectual property and technology transfer policies. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer represented the U.S., while the Chinese delegation was led by Vice Premier Liu He. The deadline for the agreement is March 1st. And finally, the British Parliament yesterday narrowly failed to approve an amendment giving it the power to instruct Prime Minister Theresa May to seek a delay to avoid a disorderly and possibly chaotic exit from the European Union on March 29th. May later lost a non-binding amendment that said the UK should not leave the EU without a Brexit deal. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to the Mueller investigation. Former presidential advisor Roger Stone entered not guilty pleas on 7 felony counts in a federal court in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and then immediately took to the airwaves to proclaim his innocence, to repeat that he will not testify against the president, and to warn the president that the Mueller investigation could mean the end of his presidency. We'll discuss that with Dr. Jerome Corsi. He's an author and political commentator who was close to Roger Stone. His latest book is Silent No More, How I Became a Political Prisoner of Mueller's Witch Hunt. Welcome, Dr. Corsi.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Jerome Corsi, Brian Becker here. Your book is How I Became a Political Prisoner and a Target of the Mueller Inquiry. How did you go writing that book to becoming what may be considered the star witness for Robert Mueller?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I consider that I still have a lawsuit against Mueller because I think that for electronic surveillance, which I think I've been under illegal electronic surveillance, I think there have been leaks from the grand jury. And if you read the book, I think certain of the techniques that were used to interrogate me or I went in to cooperate, and, you know, it had some very, very, I think, abusive moments to it. And my mind was pretty much mush by the end of this process. The special prosecutor blew up the 40 hours because I don't have a link to Assange. I've never spoken with Assange. I've never communicated with Assange. I've never had any correspondence or anything else directly or indirectly with Assange.
Let me quickly ask you then, why is Roger Stone, who the indictment is asserting and the media certainly is asserting, and including the media that's been interviewing you, like MSNBC, that Roger Stone, in fact, has a link to WikiLeaks? But why is he calling you if you don't have a link to WikiLeaks? He was your friend. Why would he call you if he already had a link to WikiLeaks?
Well, no, see, you've got to read the book and you've got to look at the timeline. In early July and August 2016, clearly, after Assange dropped 40,000 emails on Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which he did on July 22, 2016, it was clear he had more emails. As Assange was giving interviews saying he had more, and Roger wanted to know, first of all, what additionally Assange had. So in the indictment, person number one, and I have certain emails from Roger that, you know, go see Assange, and I passed them on to Ted Malik in London. So it was clear that Roger was trying to get in to see Assange. It wouldn't have been a crime to see Assange. I mean, I did my doctoral dissertation at Harvard on the Pentagon Papers case. And so, you know, it was clear I could have seen Assange. I could have even published emails Assange had. That was not a crime. The point of the indictment for Roger is that it's for lying to the House Intelligence Committee. It isn't for any Russian collusion or for any contacts that Roger may or may not have had with Assange, but I know that my testimony, my whole interaction with the federal prosecutors blew up last 20 hours of this 40-hour ordeal because I don't have a contact with Assange. Now, what's changed is that I don't think now I'll be indicted for anything because it looks like I'm not only person number one, but witness number one. I know I didn't lie, and I know I've done nothing wrong. Evidently, the testimony I've given to the special counselor, which is on record in the some of it in the grand jury, is kind of building the material case of this lying to the House Intelligence Committee that Mueller has brought against Roger Stone. And Roger Stone seems to be, you know, he's been angry at me, and he's called me a liar and all kinds of other things, including some things I think are defamatory, which we'll be dealing with legally next week. But at any rate, I'm telling my obligation as a witness will be to tell the truth to the best I can. And if subpoenaed, I will be a witness and I will tell the truth, whether that's favorable or unfavorable to Roger. You know, my obligation under God and under the law is to, you know, if I take an oath to tell the truth, I've got to tell the truth to the best of my ability.
I understand what you're saying. Jerome Corsi, I'm looking back at a Washington Post story. I think it's back in early January. I want to read these words to you and then have you respond. One email prosecutors alleged Corsi deleted was a July 25th, 2016 note from Stone in which Stone asked Corsi to try to make contact with Assange and get copies of hacked emails in his possession. The draft document says that when investigators first asked Corsi about the email, he claimed that he told Stone that trying to reach Assange was a bad idea that should be avoided. And then the next sentence, in fact, comma, Corsi forwarded the email to a London-based associate and later wrote Stone an email about WikiLeaks plans, quote, word is friend in embassy plans two more dumps, close quote. Corsi wrote Stone on August 2nd, 2016, according to a draft filing. So was Stone wrong in thinking that you might have a contact with Assange given those kind of emails, or what's your view of that?
Well, you guys haven't kept up with the news cycle here. This has been discussed now for months. First of all, that was all in the draft plea deal that the prosecutors wanted me to agree to that I rejected. I didn't agree to that deal. The first day of my testimony, I had forgotten the email that was, in fact, it was sent by me to Roger, go to see Assange, that I forwarded to Malik. I did do that. I forgot about that email. Now, the prosecutors gave me 10 days. I had not reloaded my 2016 emails because I wanted to deliver them to my computers in the condition they were the last day I used them. When I reviewed my emails, I found that one. And that testimony was amended. I've amended that testimony, and I'm now on the record of saying, yes, I did send that to Malik and was willing to have somebody go to see Assange. In fact, the current indictment of Roger makes it clear that I was being directed by Roger to find a way to talk to Assange. And that's true. I'll testify that everything in the indictment against Roger, I believe, is true. The point is, Malik never did go to see Assange, and I didn't have a contact with Assange. The point is, yes, Roger wanted there to be a contact. He instructed me to go see Assange. I never did. And I never had a contact with Assange. Even Assange has recently said in a statement that Jerome Corsi, me, I did not contact Assange and had no contact with WikiLeaks over the 2016 election or these emails stolen from the Democratic Party, or truthfully, ever. I've never been in touch with Assange or WikiLeaks.
Dr. Corsi, the Justice Department apparently accidentally let slip out yesterday that the Roger Stone grand jury is still seated. The law is if the grand jury has finished its job and has sent out indictments that it's finished, it's over. This one is still seated. Does that tell you that there are going to be additional indictments against Roger Stone, or is there some other reason why that grand jury should still be impaneled?
I don't know. You're asking me to speculate, and I have no clue. I'll have to ask Mueller why that grand jury is still in effect. I'm sure he can give you a better answer, but I doubt if he'll be so inclined.
Yeah, I doubt that as well.
Let's go to the Access Hollywood tapes issue, because part of the story, again, now the Washington Post is making the argument. The headline was just the other day, Roger Stone wanted WikiLeaks dumped to distract from Access Hollywood tape, Mueller witness says. Now, Roger Stone was in contact with you on that day. You were in an editorial meeting at World Net Daily, I believe. There was lots of information out in the public that WikiLeaks was going to have another email dump. As a matter of fact, I think Julian Assange had scheduled a press conference that was then postponed for security reasons or whatever. That's what I think Roger Stone said. The release of the WikiLeaks emails was delayed for some reason. Then on October 7th, the Access Hollywood tape broke. And that Access Hollywood tape, just to remind our audiences, it's Donald Trump on tape. He doesn't know it. He's talking to Billy Bush, and he's talking about grabbing women, abusing women. It was considered to be perhaps a campaign ender. And then an hour later, the WikiLeaks dump happened. So the story that's being spun now by, I'd say, the Washington Post and perhaps by others, and I want to get your opinion on it, is that Roger Stone or WikiLeaks, in coordination with others in the Trump campaign, released those Podesta emails to distract from the Billy Bush Access Hollywood story. But again, it seemed to me at the time, Jerome Carsey, that what was happening is everybody knew, meaning the Hillary Clinton campaign, knew that this email dump was happening. NBC, which released the Access Hollywood tapes, they were sitting on the story. They were waiting. And then they released it on the very day that WikiLeaks released its story. It distracted, in fact, from the WikiLeaks email dump because it was such sensational news. Anyway, you talked to Roger Stone that day, right?
Well, first of all, that was a day I was in New York, and a very busy day. I had a lot of meetings, a lot of phone calls. I had three phone calls. My phone call records show, and these were some of the few phone call records I saw. Verizon would not give me my list of phone calls because they don't do that anymore on phone bills, and there are contracts. It would have had to get a court order. At any rate, the special counselor's prosecutor shared with me that day's phone calls, and I had three calls with Roger Stone. Now, my recollection is that Roger asked me on that call, one of those calls, that, you know, if we could get to Julian Assange, now is the time for Julian Assange to begin his making public the emails on Roger's, on Podesta, to essentially, you know, counter in the news cycle the release of the Billy Bush tape, which was anticipated that day. Now, that's what I recall. Roger may have a different recollection of it. I don't have a recording of that call. I can't prove. I mean, what I can, you know, afterwards, I think one of the many meetings I had was a World Net Daily editorial meeting. I think I mentioned it at that meeting. But truthfully, as we look through everybody I talked to that day, I didn't have anybody I could get to that would be able to influence Assange. And the time between the phone calls and Assange actually releasing the emails was very short. So, you know, there was nobody I could have called that really made any difference. And, you know, I think Julian Assange did what he wanted to do for his own reasons. But what I can testify to is that I recall that Roger wanted to see if there was some way that we could influence Assange. And, again, that's my recollection of what I would testify to. Roger may be different on that.
Jerome Carsey, we only have about a minute left. Let me just ask you this. And again, it's speculative, but you were a principal opponent of John Kerry. You wrote the Swift Boating book. You were a principal player in the birther movement, saying that President Obama was a Muslim and maybe not an American. You said the U.S. government covered up the 9/11 attacks.
No.
Well, let me.
I never said that.
Well, let me.
I never said. No, wait a minute. You can't say on air something I didn't say.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead. You clarify, and then I'll ask you a follow up question so that we have the facts straight.
And I also don't agree with your characterization of the birth certificate issue. But what's your question about all this?
Here's my question: the MSNBC and organizations largely associated with or sympathetic to the Democratic Party considered you to be a chief nemesis of the Democrats and of President Obama. They considered you a wild conspiracy theorist. But now they seem to have changed their tune and their tone about you. You're appearing and giving your side of the story. Just how do you explain that kind of a turnaround?
Well, again, you'll have to ask them. I mean, I have been, and certainly in various of these, I've been 15 years since I've written Unfit for Command, and even then with John O'Neill, I co-authored it. John O'Neill appeared on MSNBC, had debates with Lawrence O'Donnell. I've never avoided MSNBC or CNN or any of the others. I'm happy, and I will continue to be happy to go on there when they ask me to. I've really talked to you. I've talked to really virtually all different media that have wanted to interview me, regardless of whether I think they're going to be favorable to me or not. So, you know, I'm basically trying to explain to the best I can what I perceive as you know, and in my book, Silent No More, is I think the best statement I've made so far. But I think now that it looks like I'll be called as a witness in Roger Stone's case, and so I'm much less concerned now. I don't think I will be indicted. I think it will be used as a witness. And I don't think I've done anything wrong, except for memory mistakes. And I think it would be very, very tough to convict me on a process crime. I think I would hope that Mueller and his team have abandoned that effort, which appears to be the case.
We will leave it there. We were very pleased to be joined by Dr. Jerome Corsi. He is an author and political commentator who has been close to Roger Stone in the past. His latest book is Silent No More, How I Became a Political Prisoner of Mueller's Witch Hunt. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Large-scale protests are taking place in Venezuela, both for and against the government today, after the Supreme Court moved to freeze U.S.-backed, self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido's bank accounts and to oppose a travel ban on him. Guaido responded by calling on the military to side with him, and he asked the United States to send weapons and advisors to help him overthrow the government of President Nicolas Maduro. We're joined from Caracas by Lucas Korner. He's an activist and writer for Venezuela Analysis. Welcome back, Lucas.
Great to be here, guys.
Lucas, if you watch the U.S. news networks or read the U.S. papers today, it's all about Juan Guaido and the quote-unquote return of democracy to Venezuela. There was a White House press statement today that was really telling. This is what it said. President Donald J. Trump spoke today with Venezuelan interim president Juan Guaido to congratulate him on his historic assumption of the presidency and to reinforce President Trump's strong support for Venezuela's fight to regain its democracy. It's a lot more complicated than that, in that Nicolas Maduro is the democratically elected president of Venezuela, and he has the support of his own military, he has the support of Russia and China.
And a big part of the population.
So in the coming days, what do you expect to see happen? Do you expect more violence? Do you expect some kind of a political solution in light of the fact that Maduro has offered talks with the opposition? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, my reading is the following. I think that Washington overplayed its hand. I think that they were banking on the fact that there was going to be some combination of military revolt with popular uprising. As we saw last week on Monday, that there was a small mutiny, and then there was like 3 to 4 nights of consecutive violent disturbances in working class parts of the city. But then all of that, those disturbances ended by Friday, and you know, the military question, you know, seemed totally resolved, with most of the high command coming out in support of Maduro, and there's been no signs of any other dissension. In fact, they just arrested a officer who was a dissident officer who was abroad attempting to foment unrest, and they took him into custody. So I think that in light of that failure, Juan Guaido, after swearing himself in, he disappeared for 2 days, reappeared on Friday. And then what you have is, you know, it seems that Washington has changed his strategy. You know, they just imposed an oil embargo on Monday. And, you know, now we have these reports that there are, you know, dissident military officers, quote unquote, outside of Venezuela asking for arms. So basically Contras. So, you know, this is kind of the new situation we're looking at. Of a more, clearly, the attempt to overthrow the government within a few days has not worked. So now the things are getting stretched out, and it's unclear where things are going to go, because obviously an oil embargo is going to take longer. It's going to take time for that to take effect. The crushing effects, terrible humanitarian consequences, aren't going to be seen probably for a few months. Meanwhile, you know, it clearly does not look good mediatically that, you know, Maduro is, you know, the mainstream media is just starting to realize that the Maduro government is still in power, and normal life, everyday life, is basically unchanged. People are going about their daily business here. So the issue is, well, what's going to happen next? I mean, Mexico and Uruguay are really pushing for a dialogue summit to restart negotiations between the government and the opposition, hopefully trying to peel off some of the more, you know, moderate, quote unquote, segments of the opposition that might be able be more inclined to kind of eschew this violent regime change policy that's being pursued from Washington. but it remains to be seen what's going to happen.
Do you see any effect on the political situation in Venezuela of foreign countries recognizing Guaido? The U.S. has put inordinate pressure on a lot of countries, especially in Europe and the Middle East. Does it matter that Morocco is recognizing Guaido? Does it matter that France has said that Guaido is the legitimate president?
Bahrain, the great guarantor and promoter of democracy, representing the new government in Venezuela. What a joke.
I mean, honestly, if you talk to people on the streets, I mean, what matters is not any kind of legitimacy conferred by these foreign powers, but what matters is, you know, the popular legitimacy that is represented by the government's ability or inability to solve everyday problems. And in that respect, there's a real issue of legitimacy in the sense that the Maduro government has not been able to resolve the economic crisis for a lot of different reasons that we don't have time to get into. But so the issue is, you know, at the same time, people really distrust this opposition, which is very unpopular. You know, National Assembly has a 70% disapproval rate, according to opposition line data analysis poll from October. So there isn't a lot of enthusiasm for the opposition, but there's also a lot of discontent with Maduro. Now, the question is, we have a different scenario that we did in, you know, for example, 2002 with the 2002 coup, that, you know, while you certainly had, you know, Aznar's government in Spain playing an important role with the Bush administration, largely, you know, most of the governments had not pronounced. In fact, the OAS was against the coup, interestingly enough. So the issue is, well, you have this large, you know, block of country. I mean, it's really the Europeans who are playing the role as the gravediggers of democracy in Venezuela, without a doubt, because if the Pedro Sanchez government, which, you know, has this faux progressive kind of outlook, attempting to depose as a mediator, if they, you know, and they just call for, they're basically giving the government an ultimatum to call for elections. I mean, the Sanchez government itself was not even elected. You know, the same thing with, you know, Macron's 17% approval rating, mired in political crisis and mass protests, these repressions. Likewise, you know, you have this collapsing, you know, this walking dead Tory government in the UK that also wants to lecture Venezuela on democratic legitimacy. So, you know, it's really these countries, if they were to put up just even, you know, an iota of resistance to Washington, I think that we might see a different kind of scenario playing out, but they don't appear to be doing so.
You know, one of the things that is being presented in terms of the media spin for the corporate-owned media and the U.S. government is that the backers of Maduro are the authoritarian governments like Russia or China or Iran. Now, here you have all of these countries that are recognized as authoritarian governments, like the governments in the Middle East, or a Honduras, a government that came to power through election fraud, or Bolsonaro, who's a fascist. But one thing that's false about this whole dichotomy is that this presentation that the United States and the European countries are not authoritarian countries, that they're somehow like freedom-loving countries, democracy-loving countries. In 1953, the CIA, after Britain and the United States also imposed an oil embargo like the one they're doing on Venezuela, they imposed an oil embargo on Iran. And then parts of the population arose up and had protests against the Mossadegh government, which had nationalized the Iranian oil company, or what's now BP. It was the Anglo-Iranian oil company. After the government was then successfully toppled by this violent coup led by the CIA and British intelligence, the New York Times, which is decidedly not pro-authoritarian, wrote these words in an editorial. This is following the coup, which again followed the oil embargo. Quote, "Underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their number, which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism." That's the New York Times celebrating the destruction of a democratic government and its replacement by an authoritarian government, the Shah of Iran, by intelligence services. Again, Lucas Kerner, it's part of the media sort of narrative, the media fight, the war of ideas about what is actually happening.
I mean, I think we could just go back to the April 11, 2002 coup here in Venezuela, which, by the way, Elliot Abrams, the new special envoy to Venezuela, reportedly gave the nod for it to go ahead. That the New York Times at that time labeled Pedro Carmona an editorial, a respectable businessman, Pedro Carmona, who was the appointed, the head of the dictatorship, who basically swore himself in at that moment. And they just, at that time, they dissolved the Venezuelan constitution, the very Bolivarian constitution that they're now claiming to enact this coup in defense of, which is very ironic. You know, so I absolutely agree that the media is really, you know, this is at the door of the media, that they're allowing these governments to get away with, you know, what's more authoritarian than appointing the president of another country? I mean, it would be much more legitimate, in fact, if Nicolas Maduro were to appoint Hillary Clinton president of the United States, because at least Clinton, like Maduro, won a majority of popular votes in her election, unlike Trump and Guaido. You know, and moreover, I mean, the media is not, you know, the U.S., the international media, English-speaking media principally, is allowing the administration to get away with the fact that Bolton on Thursday said that we're speaking to large U.S. oil companies. We want to open up Venezuela to these companies. It'll be in the interest of the United States and these companies. I mean, this is clearly, you know, from the horse's mouth, yet they're still allowing them to get away with this discourse of democracy that has no basis in reality.
Going to be a lot worse before it gets any better. Well, we were joined from Caracas by Lucas Corner. He's an activist and writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, CIA Director Gina Haspel, and FBI Director Christopher Wray delivered their annual intelligence threat assessment yesterday in an open hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Notably, they contradicted Donald Trump on nearly every single major issue. The Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs, ISIS, and China, for example. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Not only did they contradict the president, but they sort of provoked him into a tweet storm, saying that they're wrong, they're naive, they're stupid, they need to reassess. And then a senator wrote a tweet today saying that no matter how much evidence or information you give Donald Trump, he just believes what he believes. So in the near term, how does this dichotomy hurt American foreign policy making?
Well, I think what it shows is that we have a long-term foreign policy represented by the CIA and the Pentagon, which has led to lots of disasters, never-ending wars, regime change operations that are embarrassing, and, you know, really spending trillions of dollars where we shouldn't be spending it. Donald Trump, on the other hand, comes in and he ran a campaign saying, no to intervention, make America great again, rebuild America, was what people interpreted it as. Other people interpret make America great again as make us an empire again. I don't know. But anyway, he's now wants to get out of Syria. He wants to get out of Afghanistan. He wants to develop a relationship with North Korea that's more positive, and he wants to keep threatening Iran. On the other hand, the CIA, intelligence, and Pentagon long-term foreign policy is we don't want a war with Iran. That would be a disaster. We want to stay in Syria because we got to get control of that area, especially the area with the oil and gas. We can't go and leave Afghanistan in disgrace. They got $21 trillion in essential minerals that we need. And in North Korea, we have to have an Asian pivot in Asia. We can't allow peace with North Korea and our troops be removed from North Korea. And so there's a fight between long-term foreign policy and disruptive foreign policy. On many of these issues, Trump is right. No matter what the intelligence is, U.S. war in Syria is just going to make the problem worse. Escalation in North Korea is going to make the problem worse. Now, in Iran, I think Trump is totally off base and underestimating what it would be to go after a country that's six times as big as Iraq. And Iraq was a disaster. Iran would be much more so. And so it's a competition between the long-term foreign policy establishment versus people trying to disrupt a failed foreign policy.
You know, that's really what it comes down to. On a lot of these issues, Trump is right. And we've said so on this show. We're not afraid to say that he's right when he's right. And on some of these issues, most notably Iran.
Venezuela.
He's just plain wrong. But this is an important point that Kevin Zeese makes, is that there is a long-term policy, a foreign policy, and it's conceptualized and implemented by what many people call the deep state. And you know, we've said you can call it the federal bureaucracy or the state or whatever, but there's a long-term foreign policy that really doesn't change.
That's right. You can elect a different president, but that foreign policy establishment stays. And this is a very long-term foreign policy, really before 9/11. It's escalated since 9/11, but really 9/11 was about that foreign policy. It was about the U.S. putting bases in Saudi Arabia. And that's what angered Osama bin Laden and other Islamists. And so this is a long-term foreign policy going back decades. You can change presidents, but the foreign policy remains. It's a very hard job to redirect U.S. foreign policy away from empire and domination, both economic domination, military domination, and political domination.
Indeed. And it is the politics of empire. It's an empire that the U.S. basically, well, it's the empire with which the United States assumed hegemonic control over at least the capitalist world following World War II. There was also the socialist camp that broke up. And so the U.S. went back by, you know, in the early 1990s, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, to the world order that it had envisioned between 1943 and 45, whereby the United States would be the master of the new world order and everybody else would be turned into either junior partners or selected foes and adversaries to be toppled. One of the things, Kevin, that was noteworthy about this, a testimony by NSA, CIA, FBI in front of Congress yesterday, was the extreme focus on China. I want to read a couple sentences to you from that testimony. The Chinese counterintelligence threat is more deep, more diverse, more vexing, more challenging, more comprehensive, and more concerning than any other counterintelligence threat that I think we have, said FBI Director Christopher Wray. That's what he told lawmakers yesterday. At the same time, there was a national intelligence document that reads, China remains the most active strategic competitor responsible for cyber espionage against the U.S. government, corporations, and allies. Beijing will authorize cyber espionage against key U.S. technology sectors when doing so addresses a significant national security or economic goal not achievable through other means. As the world order is shifting, the United States is pivoting towards Asia. That started under Obama. It hasn't changed. It hasn't really shifted that much since 2011. What was your take on in terms of the preeminent focus on China here?
Great, really good point. Well, you mentioned this was a foreign policy of empire, and that empire helped work for the United States after World War II. We became the dominant capitalist force in the world. The country got wealthy from it, and we had a growing middle class, a lot of positives. But really, in the last two decades, and increasing greatly this decade, and increasingly more rapidly under Trump, the empire is failing. This last year, we changed our national security strategy from the war on terror to great power conflict, particularly focusing on Russia and China. As you said, the China pivot, the Asia pivot, began under Obama and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. It continues under Trump. He's gotten more aggressive in many ways on that. And the reason for this is because China is, in some measures, the largest economy in the world. By purchasing power parity, gross national product, China is number one, EU number two, and United States number three. Under traditional GDP analysis, U.S. is number one, but quickly losing that lead. China will be number one on that way as well, and that measure as well next year. So U.S. is seeing the falling empire, and China is the big economy, putting more into the military, responding to the Asia pivot, and allied with Russia, the other big national security threat in the U.S. national security strategy. That's what this is. This is the great power war. And what makes Venezuela interesting, in part, is both China and Russia are involved in Venezuela. China is a part owner now of Venezuela's oil. So an attack on Venezuela's oil and oil embargo is an attack on China. Russia actually has military troops and equipment in Venezuela and is telling the United States to stay out. So even in our own backyard, the great power conflict with Russia and China is escalating.
Yeah, we're talking to Kevin Zeis. Kevin is one of the contributors and editors of Popular Resistance. I want to suggest to our audience to go to popularresistance.org And in particular, look at the fact sheet that they put together on Venezuela. Excellent 5-point fact sheet. Very, very, very useful. One thing that just jumps out in our last minute, Kevin, when you looked at the news last night, you kind of felt you were at opposite day in high school or junior high school, where the National Intelligence Agency chief said everything that was exactly opposite of what Donald Trump said, exactly opposite. And then, of course, the anti-Trump media, which is, with the exception of Fox News, most of the corporate-owned mainstream media, they made this point also. But one of the things that I think is really a bad idea is for progressive people who oppose Donald Trump to think, hey, Christopher Wray and the NSA and Dan Coats are against Trump. Let's get behind them. Because when you looked at their program, with the exception of Iran, it was even to the right of Donald Trump in terms of foreign policy. 30 seconds left.
And that's true with Mueller and Comey as well. Early on in Trump's administration, he criticized the FBI and criticized the CIA. Chuck Schumer wrote a tweet saying that was a big mistake. The intelligence agencies can undermine a president in multiple ways. I think we're starting to see that play out more in Trump's final 2 years now. The presidential elections gets going. I see the Republicans beginning to stand up to him, McConnell criticizing him, and the intelligence agency openly saying Trump is wrong on foreign policy. This is a big battle between traditional empire policy versus someone who's trying to change that in some ways, good and bad. I have criticisms of Trump, but in some ways we have to recognize there's a battle going on in the foreign policy establishment.
That was the voice of Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their important work at popularresistance.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The U.S. and China met today to try to dig out from a damaging trade war with a new round of high-level talks aimed at bridging deep differences over China's intellectual property and technology transfer policies. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer represented the U.S., while the Chinese delegation was led by Vice Premier Liu He. The deadline for an agreement is March 1st. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And here in the studio, we're joined by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi there.
Happy to be here.
Jude, the U.S. press today is presenting this meeting as nothing but good news. It's high level. The two sides seem to be in general agreement and both want to come to an agreement by March 1st, this self-imposed deadline. And they're going to negotiate through dinner tonight and into the evening, according to the Washington Post. Are things really that rosy, or is this a more difficult problem than the press wants us to believe?
It will be very interesting to see the outcome, because I must admit I was feeling pretty negative. You were certainly, firstly, the Chinese offer of a preparatory delegation last week was turned down by the United States, which one can only assume was because, well, in fact, they said it was because they didn't think there was sufficient agreement to merit it. And obviously, there have been two conflicting mood musics coming out of the White House, with Mnuchin being very keen to say that there's going to be a deal, that things aren't as bad as they look, that things can all calm down, that we're heading for peace and joy and it'll all be sorted out. And Lighthizer taking a much harder line, sometimes straightforwardly contradicting what Mnuchin is saying, and having had put a negative spin on how the talks are going. So it's a bit hard to say. And then you add on top of that the legal action against Huawei, which is quite beyond the provocation of the arrest of Meng Wanzhou in Canada. This is a threat to the entire company on a scale of that was made to ZTE earlier last year.
The Chinese leadership might be concerned about the health of their economy or the effects of the U.S. trade war on the health of its economy, because in the lead up to this meeting, there are several economic indicators that came in that were pretty troubling. And now for most economies, right, the growth rates in China, which I think were just a little bit above 6%, would be great, but it does indicate a slowing down of the Chinese economy, and you add to that, you know, the drop off in foreign direct investment. I mean, do you think that the Chinese side is more willing to offer concessions to the U.S. in the past because of those types of concerns?
Well, it was 6.4%, which is the lowest for 30 years. But as you say, most countries would be delighted with that. Britain certainly would be, and I would have thought the United States would too. I don't think that slowdown is anything to do with the trade war. I think if you look at the fundamentals of the Chinese economy, there's been some decline in the share of investment in the economy, a whole number of issues which are totally tackleable from a domestic point of view, which explain that slight slowdown. Obviously, trade problems don't help. Attacks on its major companies don't help. So I am absolutely certain the Chinese side is looking for a deal, and it's made clear what it's prepared to do. It's said all along it's prepared to very, very sharply step up the rate of US imports that go into China, reducing the trade deficit, not by cutting Chinese exports to the US, but by increasing the US imports into the Chinese economy. And it's intending to rush through a law formally banning forced technology transfer. It's offered to increase the number, to ease up on investment rules for foreign companies, including allowing more financial companies to operate in China. It's offered to ease up on investment in cars and other things. So it's put quite a lot on the table. What it's not prepared to do is change the fundamental structure of its economy. And I must say that the US negotiators have made this a moving goalpost, because what they said at the beginning was the big issue, forced technology transfers, etc., should have seemed to have been conceded and agreed by China, and we can move on. But instead, a whole series of other questions to put up. No preferential state investment in Chinese companies. And that's just, the Chinese aren't going to agree to that.
Jude, how will the Huawei situation play into these talks? The U.S. Justice Department levied charges yesterday against the company and against its chief operating officer. Is that a factor in the trade talks?
Well, it won't be a formal factor, but I think it will affect how the Chinese approach the situation, because I think their approach will be, well, what is the point of us offering big concessions on one front if you just come back and hit us again on a different one? So I think it may well have the effect of somewhat toughening up the position of China, but you know, I'm not in those negotiations, so I wouldn't like to say.
Huawei is interesting. I think it ties into what we were just talking about before that, too, with the technology transfers, because Huawei is, of course, a high-tech company. It's one of the most important high-tech companies in the world. And, you know, it's crucial for China's development strategy to avoid, you know, the quote-unquote middle-income trap, to sort of develop these types of firms and capabilities. You know, this issue of technology transfers is going to be so fundamental to the talks that are kicking off today. Let's go a little bit more into detail there, because, you know, it seems like this is something that's so fundamental for China. I mean, China, of course, a long, you know, millennia-old civilization, but was, you know, effectively de facto colonized by European powers in the 1800s. You know, that's what the Opium Wars were all about. And then, you know, China, after the current Chinese government came to power, you know, in 1949, the Chinese Communist Party, they had to overcome this legacy of colonial underdevelopment. Now, in the, you know, 1940s, 50s, 60s, part of the 70s, they were pursuing one path towards that, you know, through social, you know, socialist methods of development, in terms of, you know, the expropriation of you know, the capitalist class, what capitalist class existed. You know, centralized planning over, you know, all elements basically of the Chinese economy. But there is a change in strategy in 1978, and you know, there's this period of opening up economically. You know, the exposure of the Chinese economy to international capital basically, and the logic was that, you know, this would allow us being China, to, you know, access the latest technology that's necessary to lift the standard of living for the population. And part of the deal, right, I mean, this is why I think, you know, this idea that's forced technology transfers is a little misleading, because part of the deal, right, is that China would then get to develop its own industries, its own productive capacity. But now the Western countries are saying, well, look, I mean, it's, you know, they're presenting it like, oh, like you're stealing from us. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with what you're saying, essentially. I mean, one, this didn't start out like this. Initially, deals were made. Part of the deals was technology or knowledge transfer, and nobody had any issue about that. That was just normal how the contracts were drawn up, how the agreements were reached. And then post facto, this all became China that forced people into this, and this was forced technology transfer. And I don't think you can make that stand up as to how this arose. Moreover, if you look at every really successful developed economy in the post-war period, I'm thinking of Japan, South Korea, Thailand to a certain extent, Taiwan, all of these have developed by what technology transfers, reverse engineering, i.e. taking technologies which already exist elsewhere, pulling them apart and working out how to do them themselves. That is totally normal. I would just say you gave a long historical view of China. I would say a long historical view of China would have China saying, yeah, what about the forced technology transfer from China to the Western world? For example, gunpowder, paper, many other inventions, which I don't think China ever got paid for. But that's rather a long time in the past, obviously.
But a good point, but an important point.
But I think this is a bit, China had a particular way of doing it, which was not Korea's way or Japan's way, etc. That is to enter into these contracts. But Samsung just literally stole US technology by reverse engineering. And that's how Samsung became the big successful company it is. So I just think there's double standards here.
We have just about 1 minute left, Jude. What are the prospects for a deal? If you had to guess, if you had to make a prediction based on your expertise, do you think that there's going to be some kind of agreement, even a partial one, as a consequence of these talks that are kicking off today?
I think there'll be something that both sides can present as progress. But I don't, and I'd be surprised if you got a complete breakdown. But I wouldn't be over-optimistic for what's coming out of this.
Okay, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Jude Woodward, who joined us from London. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The British Parliament yesterday narrowly failed to approve an amendment giving it the power to instruct Prime Minister Theresa May to seek a delay to avoid a disorderly and possibly chaotic exit from the European Union on March 29th. May later lost a non-binding amendment that said the UK should not leave the EU without a Brexit deal. With chaos deepening, Prime Minister May today held a meeting with Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition Labour Party. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Welcome back, Steve.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Steve, every time something like this happens in the UK, there's a corresponding announcement from the European Union saying the deal is not open to renegotiation. So what happens if there is no deal?
Well, I mean, Theresa May has been sent on another fool's errand. It's a desperate attempt to keep a Tory party together, a Conservative party together. She's gone over there and to try to renegotiate a deal that she signed off already. And the European Union have already sent a message out that they're not prepared to renegotiate it. Somebody put in the paper today, it's like British people think that if they say things very slowly and very loudly, people from different countries are going to understand them differently. It's just an absolute nonsense. And I think it's part of, when we talked before I explained it, I thought this was part of a pantomime that we're leading up to that's going to try to force Theresa May's deal through, which keeps us in the European Union. Or the alternative strategy would be go to a so-called people's vote. The European Union, the bureaucrats over in Europe, the bureaucrats in Britain, are just going to keep going until they get the decision that they want, which is that people remain in Britain and in the European Union.
I was in London, 2 weeks ago, and I was struck by how nobody has any idea what's going to happen, how this is going to play out. There are theories, of course, but there really is no way to tell what is going to happen. Do you think that there's been any movement toward second referendum or a soft border in Ireland or anything that might ease this whole process.
And let me just add in, let's talk about what Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May actually did talk about. I'm looking at the different headlines from the UK media. Labour may discuss post-Brexit customs union with Corbyn. Then Corbyn says, this is from the Independent, Corbyn says, Labour rebels, quote, will be dealt with, close quote, as he holds showdown talk. What about those discussions?
Paul, look, I think Corbyn's instincts on Brexit are right. I think he's always been on the left of the party. He's always supported a Brexit, a move out of the European Union. We have a situation where he's been badly advised and still held hostage by the Blairites in the party, the neoliberals in the party, who don't want to exit the European Union. And they're putting him in a terrible situation where, really, what they're trying to advocate is that the democratic will of the people in this country, they might not like that, but they're advocating that it is completely ignored and they have another vote, and that's no doubt another vote after that until they get the result what they want. And if that happens, I really fear for the situation that we're going to have over here.
Yeah, where will Corbyn and Labour, where is Corbyn going with this?
Well, I have no idea where he is going. I think that he's... Both parties are split. You have to understand the situation. Both parties are fundamentally split on this issue. The Conservative Party are split, but also the Labour Party are split. The constituencies in the north of England voted massively to leave. That's the Labour constituencies in the north of England. And we have the Labour constituencies around London have voted massively to remain. So each party, and the same with the Conservatives, they've got a lot of Remainer seats, a lot of lever seats. So both parties are absolutely split. This goes beyond like the traditional left-right divide. So both of them are in an absolute quandary. I think that there's a real possibility that there could be a party that emerges just on this issue alone, some sort of centrist party. That's still a possibility. But really, it's all guesswork at the minute. I don't see a clear policy coming out from the Conservative Party or indeed the Labour Party at this present time.
Well, in the event that another party is created, which we've seen periodically throughout history, how is that party going to affect its representation in Parliament? Would it be Labour Party members and Liberals and Conservatives leaving their existing parties to join this new party? And then in that case, are they able to sponsor legislation? Or does the legislation still have to be sponsored by the governing party?
Well, I mean, see, the point is that they would keep those seats. If they went to another party, they would keep those seats until the next election. So they would still be members of parliament until the next election. Of course, what the government could then do is dissolve parliament and then get rid of a lot of them and say, okay, you want to go play this game? We can have a general election next week. We'll pull the plug and see how you get on, which, to be honest, I think that we need to do. I think the general election is the only possible way out of this now. I don't think there's going to be a majority for anything in Parliament. I think Theresa May, and, you know, I almost have sympathy for the devil there. She's gone back to Brussels knowing that she's not going to get a deal in Brussels. They're not going to change the backstop for the Irish border. They're not going to risk a resurgence of the war in the north of Ireland, which that could well precipitate. So she knows that she's going over there and she's not going to achieve anything. And in a week's time or a few days' time, she's going to be back. And the civil war within her own party will recommence. So really, without a general election, I don't see how this problem can be solved.
Steve Headley is our guest. We're talking to him about the misfortunes of Theresa May, that's on a political level. Economically and socially, the misfortunes are really with the people of the UK. Because our audience doesn't really understand what's going on, if they're Americans, they don't really understand the nuances of British politics. I want to try to just spend a minute or two more probing the problem that Jeremy Corbyn has. Because as you mentioned, Jeremy Corbyn is a principled, longtime left-wing socialist pro-working class figure, and he's always been true to that. He's in this position, this rare, unusual position of being the head of the Labour Party, and the Labour Party, as you say, is conflicted. It's got deep schisms, and it's got a strong conservative element, the Blairite wing of the party. was Jeremy Corbyn, I'm just trying to understand what Corbyn was trying to achieve or to mitigate, maybe not trying to achieve, maybe just mitigate what the function or the purpose of the meeting with May would have been. Is it to make himself appear as a, quote, responsible leader, trying to work in unison to sort things out, or what's his goal?
Well, I think that, you probably hit the nail on the head there, that he has to be seen as a statesman if he's going to be the next prime minister. He's got to be seen to at least be communicating with the prime minister, the current prime minister, and putting forward his ideas. Because when it all goes belly up, as it inevitably will, well, she could validly make the argument and say, well, look, I asked you to come in and discuss this with me and you refused. No, she hasn't got that argument. He has gone in there and proposed a different strategy. By the way, it's not a strategy that I would agree with. I think it's a wrong strategy that he's proposed, but at least he has made himself appear statesmanlike and gone in and given an alternative proposal.
Well, that was the voice of Steve Hedley, who joined us from London. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.